Welcome to the latest episode of the Warships Pod. And in this one, myself and James Bosbotanis are going to try and clear up some of the fog of war surrounding the conflict between Russia and Ukraine and see if we can illuminate some of those more obscure aspects of a flank, really, that's being slightly overlooked amid all the ground warfare. So, James, how are you doing?
It's a pleasure to be joining Warships Pod again. I'm looking forward to a illuminating discussion about the naval aspects of this most regrettable conflict and discussing so far how maritime forces are involved and what the prospects are.
Yeah, and I think the scale of it is on the higher end of what we might have imagined, because I suppose what we might have thought was that the Russians would push along the coast to link up Russia itself via what is sometimes called a land bridge to Crimea and take Mariupol and other ports that currently belong to Ukraine. So have you been surprised at the actual scale of it across the whole country in general?
No, given Putin's rhetoric over the past year, and particularly his speeches last week, it very much indicated that Putin's war aims were targeted at the destruction of the Ukrainian state as a separate nation. He has described the Ukrainian government as lacking legitimacy and the Ukrainian state as lacking sovereignty. So his maximal war aims are not surprising. And unfortunately, he has decided to opt for a large-scale attack on what is the second largest country in Europe. And unfortunately, it's going to cost many, many lives on both sides.
One of the things that has been in my mind when I look at Vladimir Putin's demeanour and what he seems to be trying to achieve is that, is he thinking back with great resentment to the fact that in Desert Storm in 1991, the coalition of 500,000 troops and thousands of tanks absolutely destroyed Russian equipment and a Russian client army, if you like, in the deserts of Kuwait. And then this was followed in 1999 by Operation Allied Force, in which the Serbs were treated to NATO's war that, like this war, didn't just restrict itself to saving the Kosovars and Kosovo, but actually went and took down the bridges over the Danube in Belgrade. And so he's been looking at conflicts like that, where the Western allies have showed how defective and wanting Russian technology. And also the West, led by NATO in some ways, but really America, Britain and France, with support from Italy and others, in Libya in 2011, also took down a former client state of Russia. So he saw lots of client states and lots of Russian weaponry and technology being reduced and beaten by Western technology. And he's kind of looking at also the invasion of Iraq in 2003, where the Allies staged an amazing blitzkrieg that took Baghdad, which was, although it had its problems, succeeded in the initial stage, although of course what came after was a disaster. So do you think that Vladimir Putin, simmering there in the Kremlin, has been looking at the past 20 to 30 years and thinking partly, now that I've revived the Russian military, I'm going to show them what we can do and we're going to establish our area of influence in Central and Eastern Europe?
Yes, I think this is going to be a major factor in Putin's thinking. He had spoken about the use of American military power, the overthrowing of friendly regimes, pushing back the coloured revolutions. The Russians had looked through their past couple of decades of military modernization. They saw Desert Storm as a proof of concept. They looked begrudgingly but admiringly at how US military power was displayed to such dramatic effect in Desert Storm, less so in Kosovo, but that was more of a political failure than a failure of the actual military technology. And of course, in 2003 with Optelec, Operation Iraqi Freedom. So I think he obviously wanted his shot at a massive Russian display of overwhelming force. They telegraphed it in Syria in 2015, where they put together a coordinated multi-directional missile assault against Islamic State targets. And they were looking to do something like that, but full scale in Ukraine. But contrary to many expectations, it looks like the Russian ambition has failed to match Russian reality. The scale of the opening missile salvo against Ukrainian targets was significantly smaller than anticipated. The United States has said that the Russians have so far used about 250 ballistic missiles. The opening strikes involved perhaps around 100 plus Iskanders and about 100 air-launched or sea-launched cruise missiles, perhaps up to 30 calibers from ships in the Black Sea fleet. Given that the Russian Air Force, for example, with its Bears, you would be looking at 100 cruise missiles coming from 8 to 10 Bear aircraft. The scale of the opening Russian cruise missile offensive has been much, much smaller. And Russian use of cruise missiles in the intervening period has not come up to the sort of levels that the US was displaying against Iraq in 2003. Is this a Russian political decision holding back? Did they anticipate that perhaps Ukraine did not require such a dramatic use of force, that politically it would be coerced into surrendering with a show of force? Is it a decision by the Russians to hedge and hold back because they fear NATO intervention and so they have to hold on to as many of their long-range cruise missiles as possible for targeting European targets? Is it that the Russian economy simply has not been able to produce the numbers of cruise missiles required for Russia to be capable of conducting a sustained large-scale bombardment? In 2019, I looked at the figures for caliber production. In 2018, the Russians stated they had received around 100, 120 caliber cruise missiles that year. Now, assuming that the Russians are capable of delivering 100, 120 caliber cruise missiles a year, plus their air-launched weapons, you could see very quickly that using 400 or 500 or 600, or getting up to American Operation Iraqi Freedom levels, would very quickly exhaust their arsenal and then leave them vulnerable in their eyes to not possessing the required number of weapons to hold NATO targets at risk. And of course, in a NATO contingency, Russia would very heavily rely on its cruise missile forces because its air power would be extremely vulnerable to NATO defensive systems and their NATO air forces.
Well, I mean, that's very interesting what you say there. And one of the things that occurred to me when you were discussing that was that perhaps this shows also, in addition to not having enough missiles in general and wanting to hold them back to attack NATO, if we in the eyes of the Kremlin make the mistake of taking on Russia, but also is it also an illustration of the limitations of the warships and the submarines that Russia is relying upon? Because, of course, in NATO, you would have Arleigh Burke-class destroyers. You'd also have the submarines of the US Navy and the Ticonderoga-class cruisers. And those are much bigger, much more powerful, and probably have a lot more missiles. So is it also the truth that small corvettes or relatively small submarines and surface warships like they have in the Black Sea fleet to fire the caliber cruise missiles, is it the case that they're just not up to the job of the same kind of mass assault with cruise missiles that the Americans staged in their wars?
Yes, I think that's a very good point. A Russian corvette in the Black Sea will be armed with perhaps 8 calibers in its VLS. So it fires them at Ukraine. It has to go back to port in Russia to rearm. An Arleigh Burke-class destroyer with its 96 vertical launch system tubes split between anti-submarine, anti-air and Tomahawks. If it dedicates half those VLS tubes to Tomahawks, it's carrying 48 Tomahawks. And the diesel electric subs, the improved kilos, they'll be carrying, say, between 4 and 8 calibers, probably split between the land attack variant and the anti-ship variant. In contrast, a US Ohio class SSGN in the start of the Libya campaign fired about 100 Tomahawks out of its 154. So the scale of naval cruise missile fires that the Russians can deliver is a fraction of what the US Navy can deliver. Of course, the Russians are working on equipping their larger surface combatants with caliber cruise missiles. They've converted an Udaloy with their VLS. They've got the Gorshkov class. Of course, only 3 Gorshkov class frigates have entered service thus far, partly delayed because the Russians had to substitute Ukrainian supplied parts after 2014. The Admiral Nakhimov is being refitted and that will have the capacity for 80 calibers. But the Russian shipbuilding industry works at a glacial pace, and the Russians simply have not got the frigates, destroyers or cruisers of the US Navy has. Their submarines, yes, they are entering service. They got the new Yasin and Yasin M class with capacity for 32 calibers. There's only 3 in service now, with another half a dozen due. But you're not going to be sending a Yasin M class boat into the Black Sea. You're going to be holding those back for, ideally, in Russian planning, operations against the most pressing targets. That'd be the United States. You'd be leaving the job of hitting European targets to Russian air-launched weapons and ships that can operate, the corvettes that can operate under the protective umbrella of Russian land-based air power from the Baltic and Black Sea.
And it is interesting thinking about the capacity of the US Navy, which far exceeds the Russians, as you've just said, but also it far exceeds the European NATO navies. And in looking at the Russians, as you've just explained, who are upgrading the Admiral Nakhimov, and they're going to have more Gorshkov class frigates and also guided missile submarines, NATO, it would appear to me, has a window of opportunity now, if it wakes up and it gets a move on, to actually match the Russians as well, or try and match them and upgrade its own armament in terms of naval firepower, cruise missiles like the French Scalp, and also in the UK. I mean, you mentioned the guided missile submarine that fired in the opening salvo of the Libya campaign, and I think that was actually 96 Tomahawks, and that was more than Britain, with its nuclear-powered attack submarines, has in its entire inventory in one salvo, or not one salvo, but in one mission. And so it seems to me that we do have an opportunity now in NATO navies of Europe to try and make up for years and years of neglect, and particularly in the Royal Navy, which has, unlike the French Navy, has no surface fleet land attack capability, which is quite astonishing. But do you think that's true, that we do have a narrow window where if we get a move on, we can try and close the gap in terms of land attack and other firepower that the Russians are gradually improving?
Absolutely, yes. And with regard to the Royal Navy, the Type 26, the City-class frigates, are the primary opportunity there, as they will be fitted with the Mark 41 vertical launch system, which can take Tomahawk or, for example, the American SM-6 Block 1B. It was originally an anti-air weapon, but it has an anti-ship capability, and it may have a land attack capability added subsequently. If we can start accelerating progress on the Type 26, look, for example, at the Type 32 general purpose frigate, stick an 8-cell Mark 41 VLS in that, we can deploy Tomahawks at sea and make sure that the Russians understand that, for example, a NATO surface action group in the Baltic, it's not just a threat to the immediate Baltic region, it can project power deep into Russia. So the Russians do not have any idea that they can think, oh, we've got a few days window of opportunity to do land grabs somewhere because The Americans are going to be a few days away with their heavy firepower. And of course, with a ship like the Type 26, yes, it's got the land attack capability that you can add through Tomahawk in the Mark 41, but the Mark 41 system can also hold anti-missile interceptors. And as we saw in the opening salvos in Ukraine, the Russians rely on their ballistic missiles, the Iskander-M, and their cruise missiles, and sending NATO warships that have missile defense capabilities, for example, to the Baltic, shows Russia that your opening salvo of ballistic and cruise missiles can be defended against by NATO ships, and we can project power back at you with Tomahawk or whatever else comes along. And I see it's been reported in the past few days that the Royal Navy's future cruise and anti-ship weapon due to enter service by the end of this decade will be Mark 41 capable. So we can, with our allies, really, by the end of this decade, start to deploy many, many more weapons at sea. And the Type 45 destroyer, I'm not sure now if it's possible that after the decision was announced to fit it with Sea Scepter, but space had been allowed for the fitting of a Mark 41 VLS. If that could also be done, that would be a very welcome addition to the Royal Navy. And, you know, looking further afield to the Type 83 next generation destroyer that's due to enter service in the late 2030s, you know, we should be looking at how we can maximize the capability of that to not just contribute to the anti-air warfare battle, but as the United States, Japan, South Korea do, how it can be a genuinely multi-role surface combatant.
Yeah, I mean, that's possible if the will's there and if the determination's there and the funds are made available. And the Ukraine war should be the wake-up call, the final wake-up call for the West. I mean, magazines like Warships and other people, other commentators, experts, people like yourself speaking at conferences or wherever, have suggested that we need to wake up for years, and that the Russians, although they've been derided in many ways with their navy, have made improvements, have upgraded things, and are moving on to the next step. So we need to actually take action now and stop being so turgid in all the naval procurement programs and other procurement programs across UK and European defence that occur. Having talked about the need for the Royal Navy and other NATO navies to actually improve their firepower, and with new ships like the Type 26 City-class frigate to use the vertical launch systems for land attack missiles, it is interesting that the German government has decided that it will go above 2% of GDP for defence, because Germany has been very, very, very hesitant for reasons of history and culture and politics to raise their defence spending. And the Navy, although useful, has not really done a lot outside the European waters. They have sent a frigate to the far side of the world in the past year, and they have done deployments around Africa. But their Navy, although professional and with some very effective and capable warships, is not very large. So it is very, very interesting to see that the Germans have done that. So do you think that heralds across NATO, James, do you think that heralds across NATO there'll be a raise in defence spending?
I would very much hope so. And although the Russian military may appear to be a large, potent force on the ground, economically, the balance of power is, even without the United States, very much in Europe's favour. The Russians have an economy of $1.5 plus trillion, or purchasing power parities. You know, how far Russian spending goes in comparison to, say, British spending does change figures. But in economic terms, Russia simply cannot hope to compete with Europe, let alone the combined strength of Europe and the United States. And if European countries start increasing defence spending to the NATO minimum of 2%, or perhaps in certain cases, for example, in 1990, the UK was spending nearly 4% of GDP on defence. If we can match words with actions. You know, we are committed to the defense of Europe, to the defense of our values, to the defense of our freedom from Russian expansionism and seeking to overturn the post-Cold War international order. We can considerably strengthen our defenses. We can afford to considerably strengthen our defenses, and we can all collectively ensure our security.
But when it comes to looking at the naval side of the war, the Ukraine war, as we now call it, what do we know, do you think, about some of those aspects? I mean, I'll start off with the now legendary, it's only been a few days, but the now legendary Battle of Snake Island, which was this small island with, I think, a research facility on or something. I'm not sure. I mean, it's all part of the fog of war, where there was a small garrison of Ukrainian Coast Guard troops who were confronted with the Russian guided missile cruiser Moskva and, I believe, a corvette, which were both armed with, obviously, guns and also missiles, and basically issued a fruity FU. Russian warships, we're not going to surrender. You threatened us and told us to surrender, but we're not going to surrender. I mean, I don't know how much you know about that incident, but if it was as seems, why would the Russians feel they needed to bombard and obliterate a small island with 13 Ukrainian servicemen on to the west, I believe, of the Crimea? Do you have any ideas what was going on there?
Looking at the location of the island on there, close to the Ukrainian border with Romania and the Danube Delta, one can assume that perhaps the Russians wanted to secure the western flank of any potential naval deployment towards Odessa.
And the thing about the Snake Island last stand, as it was originally depicted, was that it was about the defiance of the Ukrainians, showing the Russians that actually they weren't going to fold in a few days and they weren't going to give up without a fight and just roll over and give President Putin his dominance over Ukraine. And I do notice from the headlines that actually the troops, some of the troops at least, who said go forth and multiply, actually are alive. They didn't get obliterated by the Russian Navy. But I don't think that's the point. I'm glad to see they're alive. And President Zelensky of Ukraine could now, rather than posthumously give them the highest order of bravery that Ukraine can give to combatants, can now, when they're released one day by the Russians, present them with their medals in person, provided he survives, of course. So I think it is good that they didn't make their last stand and get obliterated. And hopefully the Russians will soon release them back to their families.
And I'm not aware of any Ukrainian anti-ship missile systems being deployed on that island. From a cursory look on Google Maps at the island, it doesn't appear to have cover or anything. So perhaps it's much more of a Russia asserting that they are taking Ukrainian territory rather than perhaps any strictly military rationale for it. And of course, then having the potential that if they choose to deploy any systems themselves there, that they can pose a risk to any moves that would threaten the western flank of their moves towards Odessa. But I think it was much more just a demonstrative expression of Russian power. You've got to question the rationale of the Russians keeping a 13,000 ton cruiser in the relatively confined waters of the Black Sea. But that's been a recurring theme in Russian debates for some years now, whether the Black Sea Fleet should have the Moskva. But, you know, it was overkill, really.
I did wonder, amid trying to figure out what was happening with the amphibious vessels that we talked about in the previous episode, and as we've written about in the magazine, having assembled their amphibious force of landing ships from the Northern Fleet, the Baltic Fleet and the Black Sea Fleet, along with other craft as well, how they would use them. And I wondered if the attack on Snake Island was all about getting a kind of a staging area for them to then move on Odessa. And I've also been looking at what has or hasn't happened at Mariupol or near Mariupol. And the US Department of Defense has said in a briefing that there have been landings near Mariupol. And I'm unclear at the moment about whether anything's happened near Odessa. And it strikes me that the way the Russians would work, and this would be classic Russian tactics or strategy, if you like, would be to try and secure the Mariupol area or the Odessa area if they can via a thrust along the coast, using maybe naval infantry brigades from Crimea or wherever, or army units, and then bring in more force and possibly have more firepower standing off the coast when they think they've got secure areas ashore. Because during the Second World War, the Russian Navy was very active in the riverine sense, in the Black Sea, and in supporting the Russian army, the Red Army, very much, and not so active at sea in blue water operations. So do you think that there have been actual amphibious operations, troops put ashore, and that they are using that pattern of supporting what the army's already done to secure areas to take everything across the beach? Do you think that's what's been happening? Has any of that happened?
I would agree. It does look like there has been some sort of amphibious landing on the Sea of Azov in support of operations against Mariupol. The United States has, as you said, mentioned that. In terms of the moves towards Odessa, I would suspect that the Russians may land naval infantry eventually after a land-based thrust has secured a viable beachhead. I doubt the Russians would want to be conducting an opposed amphibious landing, especially as Ukrainian forces have not been degraded in the way that they expected. And of course, having a amphibious force poised at sea will be fixing Ukrainian forces around Odessa and preventing them from deploying to, for example, Kherson or Mykolaiv to meet the Russian thrusts coming up from Crimea. So I would expect that there will be subsequent amphibious landings, but of course, as you said, the Russians in World War II operated in this manner. And just as a historical footnote, the commander of the Soviet Navy from 1956 to the mid-1980s, Admiral Sergei Gorshkov, he was heavily involved in operations in the Black Sea and the riverine operations on the Danube. But given that Ukrainian resistance has not been degraded, the Russian Navy would be extremely concerned about the possibility of Ukrainian coastal batteries targeting Russian ships. The Ukrainians got a hit with an SS-21 against Milarovo Air Base in Rostov region in southern Russia, just across the border from Ukraine. So they've got the guile and they've got the tactical capability to hit back. And the Russian Navy, the last thing it wants to see is one of its LSTs on fire and Russian troops dying in large numbers, especially after reported downing of a couple of Russian Air Force Ilyushin 76s with their airborne forces potentially suffering heavy casualties.
So that missile that was fired into southern Russia, was that a ballistic missile, or was, just for the benefit of our listeners, was that a ballistic missile, or was that some kind of shore-based missile battery that decided to have a pop at firing something? What kind of weapon was that?
No, it was reported an SS-21, or to use a Russian name, Tochka-U. It's a tactical ballistic missile, range of about 60-70 miles, with a terminal radar guidance system, developed in the 1970s, if I remember correctly. In Russian service, it's been replaced by the Iskander, so it's designed very much for battlefield use.
So with the Ukrainians having the shore batteries, I mean, we think about these anti-tank weapons that have been given to them by NATO nations, etc. But they do have shore-based guided missile batteries to fire at approaching warships. And that obviously, as you said, will be preying on the minds of the Russian planners. So have they fired any of those weapons out to sea? I mean, there's been talk of merchant vessels being hit, several merchant vessels being hit. So might that be an error on their part? They fired at a Russian vessel, missed it? Or are the Russians firing at merchant vessels? Do we know anything about that? I mean, it's very much in the fog of war. The Ukrainians, their Ministry of Defence seems certain that the Russians have attacked merchant vessels, including, I think, at least two from NATO nations. So do we know anything about what's going on there at sea?
There haven't been any reports of Ukrainian coastal batteries launching any weapons. The reports of attacks on merchant vessels seem to suggest that it's been inadvertent Russian fire. They've, I believe they've targeted a couple of Turkish ships, a Moldovan flagship, initially reported as Romanian, and a Japanese vessel, which attracted a response from Tokyo. There have also been reports of a friendly fire incident, potentially, with the Russian Black Sea Fleet downing a Russian aircraft over the Black Sea, which may be related to the Ukrainians claiming yesterday to have downed a Sukhoi 30 SM over the Black Sea. But the Russians appear to be imposing a de facto blockade of the Ukrainian coast. The approaches to Odessa, they've told maritime traffic to clear the northern Black Sea. So it's possible that there will be further attacks against civilian traffic in the region. And this is, of course, extremely dangerous and escalatory. And it just shows, again, you know, the Russian disregard for what they're doing.
And that's why that blockade, if you like, of Ukrainian ports to the north, is that why there's been reportedly a Russian statement saying that merchant shipping should clear out of the northern part of the Black Sea and go south and as far away from up there as they can, do you think?
I would think so, yes. I think what the Russians want to do is cripple Ukraine economically, of course, impose a blockade on the Ukrainian coast. Obviously, the Russians are launching a land-based thrust along the Ukrainian coast, probably with the eventual target of Odessa. And, you know, they don't want any third-party ships getting in the area. They presumably will be wanting just to know that any ship that is in the area is Ukrainian and can be targeted. It's an extremely dangerous situation to any commercial traffic in the area.
It is. I mean, it just put me in mind there of thinking about the Second World War, but actually more like the First World War, where I think there was a lot more naval activity in the Black Sea. So it's quite extraordinary that we're now in the position of you and I sitting here talking about rogue missiles, let's say, or bombardments of islands, and also a blockade of, you know, Ukrainian ports, what would have been Russian ports in the First World War. So it's quite extraordinary. But looking beyond the Black Sea to elsewhere in the world, and in particular into the Mediterranean and the Eastern Mediterranean, there is, of course, a lot of Russian hardware in the Eastern Mediterranean. Some of it's come from the Black Sea Fleet, and that is in close company with NATO vessels. And before we look at the components of NATO that are in the Mediterranean, an interesting aspect of this that has arisen with just a few days into the war is the president of Ukraine asking the president of Turkey to close the Turkish Straits to Russian naval vessels. And at one stage, President Zelensky thanked the Turkish leader for doing that. But in fact, there's neither confirmation as I speak or denial that Turkey will do that. And that raises the issue of the Montreux Treaty, which governs passage of warships and what warships from what they call riparian states can do in the Black Sea, what kind of warships are in the Black Sea. And so it's very complex. And we will have an article by Çim Devrin Yeylali, our man in Istanbul, in the next magazine. But very simply, what do you know of the situation there with this plea by President Zelensky for the straits to be closed? And what do you think to that whole idea of Turkey doing that?
I don't believe that under the terms of the Montreux Convention, Turkey can, under normal circumstances, close the straits to Russian warships. I think there may be provision, and I'm not an expert on the Montreux Convention, but I think there may be a provision in it for the Turks to deny access to the straits in the event of war between Russia and Turkey. Obviously, Russia and Turkey are not at war. But at the moment, although if Turkey were to make an announcement to that effect, it would be more symbolic than anything, because the Russian Navy has the Black Sea Fleet in the Black Sea. The Ukrainian naval threat it can be dealt with by the ships the Russians already have in, plus their shore and air-based missile systems. So there isn't actually a need to deny the straits to the Russians.
Right. I mean, I don't want to preempt what we'll have in the mag, but from the way I understand it, that Turkey does, under the convention, have full control over the straits. And the main thing it guarantees is free passage of civilian vessels in peacetime, and according to what Chim has written, and permits Turkey to remilitarize the Turkish Strait. So I think there's an amount of flexibility there, but it probably would be wise for Turkey in terms of governing the passage to and from to just stick to what the rules are at the moment. Because, of course, if Russia sees that Turkey has decided that it will stop Russian naval vessels going to and from the Black Sea via the straits at a time of war, then it could be that Russia will say, well, you should stop NATO vessels coming in for their 3 weeks, their three permitted weeks patrolling the Black Sea. Though I would be doubtful that NATO at the moment, other than the NATO states that have warships in the Black Sea, that would be Romania, Turkey and Bulgaria, would go in there. I just don't think they would go in there right now. And anyway, there's other technicalities as well about whether or not Russia's technically declared war. And so without technically declaring war, it's called a military operation. And maybe under the convention, you don't close the straits to the belligerents' warships. So I think that's all there. But that'll be in the magazine. But turning back to the Eastern Mediterranean, as you said, there's plenty of hardware in the Eastern Mediterranean that belongs to Russia, some from the Black Sea Fleet, and then, of course, there's enough to handle what's going on in the Black Sea Fleet, as you just explained. But it also strikes me that if the Russians were in a position where they couldn't put their vessels through the straits, they do have Tartus in Syria as a logistical support base anyway. So looking at the scale of what they have in the Eastern Mediterranean and what NATO has, what risk do you think is there that there will be some kind of dangerous confrontation? Because when people talk about the war on land, of course, the Russians are invading Ukraine, and there's a fair few hundred miles, certainly at the moment, before any Russian ground forces will come face to face, although I believe some have been seen moving along close to the Polish border. But in terms of offensive posture, I think we're away from any Russian armoured brigades or whatever being face-to-face, eye-to-eye, toe-cap-to-toe-cap with NATO forces along NATO's eastern border. But at sea, we do have warships and also, I would presume, submarines that are fully armed, potentially on a war footing, and are quite close to each other. So that is actually an unknown to most people aspect of this whole crisis. So how do you see the situation in the Eastern Mediterranean and how tricky it could or might not be at the moment?
The Russians have assembled a very potent force in the Eastern Mediterranean. It had been positioned to counter the deployments of NATO carriers, the Harry S. Truman, the French Charles de Gaulle, and the Italian Navy's carrier. I believe in recent days it returned to Tartus for a end of exercise photo opportunity or something. So Russian naval forces are concentrated off the Syrian coast at the moment, but it's nonetheless a very formidable force centered on the Russian Navy's other two Slava-class cruisers. And of course, that force is designed, the Slavas were built in the 70s, 80s, for operations against NATO carrier strike groups. And the Russians have positioned this very potent force in the Eastern Mediterranean to secure, as it were, their southern flank. Obviously, tied into the operations in Ukraine, their worst-case scenario is that NATO or NATO member, such as the United States, chose to unilaterally intervene. The Russians would want to defend their southern flank, and that would mean countering, for example, a US carrier strike group. And alongside the surface ships and submarines that the Russians have in the Eastern Med, known, of course, a couple of their improved Kilo-class boats, but I would very much expect a nuclear-powered submarine from the Northern Fleet accompanied the surface action group from the same fleet. The Russians also have a powerful anti-ship missile capability in Syria. They've deployed at least one MiG-31 IK equipped with a Kinjal hypersonic missile, four backfire bombers, of course, designed in the Cold War to attack American carriers with its AS-4 Kitchen supersonic anti-ship missiles. They've been forward deployed to Syria. There are also Russian Air Force Sukhoi 34s deployed in Syria, and it's over the years since the 2015 deployment. They have been observed armed sometimes with anti-ship missiles. And the Russians have their shore-based SSC-5 Stooges deployed in Syria. And the Iskander-M, which it's believed can also be used as an anti-ship ballistic missile. So there is a very powerful Russian anti-ship capability in the Eastern Mediterranean. And it's there as a signal to NATO navies that they can contest control if necessary. And certainly the two Slavas are both carry a formidable anti-ship missile armament. The SSN-12 Sandbox, which, again, it was designed in the Cold War to target American aircraft carriers.
And I think your mention of Syria and those shore-based and air-launched missiles there illustrates something which people often forget, sometimes forget, and that is that their only aircraft carrier is the Kuznetsov, which in certain circles in the West is seen as a joke because it's old, it can't carry very many aircraft, and when they do take them somewhere, it's very difficult for their jets to even get off the deck with a full load of weapons. But what people overlook is, of course, that the Russians have a non-moving aircraft carrier called Syria in the Mediterranean, as you just explained, with jets there and also the shore-based guided missiles. And they also have another aircraft carrier, inverted commas, in the Baltic, which is the Kaliningrad enclave. And so they could dominate the Baltic as well without having an aircraft carrier. And so one of the things that I noticed in the 2016s, 2017s, was that the Kuznetsov would be sent from the Northern Fleet and would be a subject of ridicule in the Western media for having a tug and making a lot of smoke. But she would be carrying fighter jets to Syria, which then flew ashore and operated from there. So the Russians, as ever, mix and match and make the best of what they've got. And looking at NATO's deployment at sea, outlined by the Secretary General the other day, he said that there are 100 jets on high alert protecting airspace. And he also said that more than 120 Allied ships are at sea from the high north to the Mediterranean. So that's an impressive scale, including the Harry S. Truman, the Italian carrier Cavour, and the French carrier Charles de Gaulle, which has just been assigned to NATO command for potential action in the Mediterranean. But then we also have the HMS Prince of Wales and a load of other NATO major units about to go north into the Arctic on exercise cold response, where the Russians have also got a surface action group led by the nuclear-powered battlecruiser Peter the Great, to use its English name. And I believe the Americans are readying the George H.W. Bush aircraft carrier strike group in the Western Atlantic. And so there's a lot of hardware out there being moved into place. And so do you think that the maxim that's being used at sea, and inevitably, is that everybody should just keep a calm head and think very, very coolly about what is going on and be careful not to have some kind of terrible accident? Because that surely is the main problem, is some kind of miscalculation or accident in the heat of the moment.
Absolutely. And for example, in the confines of the Eastern Mediterranean, if an accident were to occur, it could deteriorate extremely rapidly, because with modern anti-ship missiles, it is essentially a battle of the first salvo. And for a Russian commander, he would know that his only opportunity really is to launch off what he's got before it's lost. And although NATO does have overwhelming maritime superiority with respect to Russia, the Russians possess some formidable maritime capabilities, and the potential for a grievous accident resulting in extremely destructive turn of events cannot be ruled out. And seeing how the Kremlin is acting, how it is viewing the international situation, one has to be concerned that they are going down the same lines as the Soviet Union did in the early 1980s. Yuri Andropov was in the Kremlin and beset by paranoia and conspiratorial thinking of imminent American attacks, which led to the extremely dangerous war scare of November 1983 surrounding a NATO command post exercise called Able Archer, and the Soviets are believed to have even started moving nuclear warheads around to their forces in Eastern Europe. Looking at how Putin is acting now, the possibility that he would see a close encounter in the Eastern Mediterranean as perhaps a precursor to a NATO intervention against his forces in Syria, as a precursor to moving up towards Ukraine, or seeing NATO maritime forces in the high north as moving to take position to strike Russia's forces on the Kola Peninsula whilst they were vulnerable, it cannot be ruled out. And certainly in the 1980s, the Soviets were extremely sensitive to the large-scale NATO, particularly US-UK-led carrier exercises in the Norwegian Sea, and seeing the George H.W. Bush carrier strike group and HMS Prince of Wales converging into, say, the Norwegian Sea, the Northern Fleet's admirals would be thinking, oh, I wish we didn't have our Slava-class cruiser and surface action group down in the Eastern Mediterranean. Because I would also very much expect and hope that Peter the Great has a UK or USSSN tailing it.
Yeah, and the thing we need to be, of course, which perhaps was forgotten in the glow of the post-Cold War victory of the West, was that we do need to be slightly sensitive to how Russia sees the world from its position. Of course, that doesn't mean that we should defend our values, our borders, but that potential for a left field trigger, and it could come at sea, very much could come at sea. Everybody's looking at the war in Ukraine and they're being extra careful there, but you know, there could be, without the professionalism on both sides, Russian and NATO and the West, there could be some kind of episode, and it actually could happen somewhere thousands of miles from where we're actually focusing at the moment. And an example of that, which again, you know, we don't know the full details of it, but there was a very tricky moment in the Pacific when the Russians claimed that they had deployed their own vessels on an exercise close to the Kuril Islands, and that a American nuclear-powered attack submarine, they said the Virginia-class, one of the most modern American attack submarines, had intruded into these exercises. So they then sent their anti-submarine vessel, Shaposhnikov, to pursue this vessel and use some kind of sonar device to chase it away. And that they did get very, the Russians did get very upset about that, and strong words were exchanged, and the Americans remained rather oblique about it, as they would do, because they would never admit that the submarine was there or not. So there are trigger points at sea all around the world, potentially.
Absolutely. And a startling lesson from history is, of course, in the Cuban Missile Crisis, perhaps the closest the US and the Soviet Union came to war was a US destroyer depth charging a Soviet submarine, trying to force it to surface, and not knowing that that submarine had a nuclear armed torpedo on it. And the Soviets were debating whether to go down, take a US carrier task group with them. So tactical decisions made in the heat of the moment by a surface warship captain or a submarine captain could easily and completely inadvertently trigger a chain of events that results in a much, much more dangerous situation.
I agree. And as we look at the war on land, which who knows where that's going to go? It looks pretty horrific as it is, and it could easily get much, much worse, and could be a very, very devastating war in the heart of Europe and lead to mass casualties among civilians and slaughter on all sides. So I think we are walking the razor's edge. We are crawling along that razor's edge already. And so I think we need to be extra careful to bear in mind, particularly with somebody like President Putin, who never hesitates to threaten what he calls nuclear restraint. And in recent days, you know, basically threatening that he'll unleash historic devastation on the West and NATO if it dares to intrude into the Ukrainian war on the ground or even in the air. I think we need to be very, very careful that we recall that always looming over us, and it's something that perhaps most people have forgotten about, is the spectre of a nuclear war. And, you know, you never like to end a podcast on a downer, but it's true. And I think that everybody needs to be aware that the stakes here are very, very high. We've obviously been talking about the sea and what happens out there for a little while. But looking at the ground war, which doesn't seem to be going to plan for the Russians, what effect did you think overall the Russian ground offensive failing utterly would have in terms of potential escalation?
I think it holds a significant risk. The Russians seem to have developed an operational plan that prioritized speed and the attainment of rapid victory. And with that seemingly now not being realized, Ukrainian resistance being much stiffer, I can see the Russians escalating both in terms of their attacks targeting civilian areas to try to terrorize the Ukrainian people into surrendering, the use of more powerful weaponry, in particular thermobaric weapons that they used, for example, in Chechnya, and ultimately the possibility that Russia would, to stave off operational failure, resort to the use of, for example, chemical weapons, cannot be dismissed. And in a worst case scenario, the possibility that Russia would consider the use, for example, of a tactical nuclear weapon is a risk that has to be factored into Western thinking. The Russians have reportedly today shelled, albeit not causing significant damage to a nuclear waste facility outside Kiev. They are approaching the second largest nuclear power station in Europe, in southern Ukraine. And there is very much a nuclear factor involved in Russian thinking. And Russian military debates have referred to the use of prohibited weapons as asymmetric counters. We have seen Russia use, for example, the nerve agent Novichok in the UK. Does that capability extend beyond a tool of assassination to a larger scale, latent chemical weapons capability? And the Russians, of course, also possess a broad spectrum of nuclear weapons ranging from tactical to strategic. And I would be concerned that the Russians would, in a worst case scenario, opt to use a nuclear weapon to try to scare Ukraine into surrender.
Wow. I mean, that's a horrific menu of things the Russians could do, and also a terrible, awful picture or future in terms of the war in Ukraine to think about. So for me, I just have to hope, I pray that somebody like Vasily Arkhipov, who was the officer in that submarine that was depth charged off Cuba with the nuclear tip torpedo, that somebody like Vasily Arkhipov, who said to the captain, who was mad with fury at the Americans for keeping a submarine down for a long time and depth charging, hopefully there's a Vasily Arkhipov somewhere in the Russian power structure who could have a word with President Putin, or somewhere in the command structure of the military who would just refuse to do that because it's just totally horrific. But let's hope it doesn't come to pass. Thanks very much for coming in, James. And I think we've had a pretty fascinating discussion there and covered a lot of topics and looked at some aspects of the land campaign, but also, of course, the naval side, which may be getting neglected elsewhere. So I really do appreciate you taking time out in your busy schedule to chat with me about that.
Thank you very much, Ian. It is always a pleasure to chat with you and discuss the naval aspects of what is a terrible situation. And we can only hope that diplomacy can bring an end to the Russian assault on Ukraine, and Russia and Ukraine can move forwards, and the Kremlin can have a change of heart and realize that its future is in peaceful relations with its neighbors, not accumulating frozen conflicts, ceasefires, and armies of occupation.
For more news on the naval side of the Ukraine war, and also, of course, global naval events, get Warships International Fleet Review magazine in hard copy or digital. We do have a special section on the naval side of the Ukraine conflict.